Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Joe Biden is in legacy mode. He has less than 2 months to leave his historical mark. He will be remembered for being unfit for office and being one of the engineers of the Palestine genocide. To cap it all off, we can add Kamikaze Joe playing a game of nuclear chicken with Russia. Crosstalking Biden's legacy, I'm joined by my guest Wilmer Leon in Washington. He is a political scientist, author, and a radio talk show host. In Seattle, we have Sarah Bills. She is a former U.S. Navy service member, a geopolitical analyst, and one of the hosts of DD Geopolitics. And in Montreal, we cross to Eve Engler. He is a Canadian Foreign Policy Institute fellow, also a journalist, as well as an author. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Sarah, let me go to you first, since you got up earliest for the program. Much appreciated. In Seattle. You know, I was thinking about doing this program Sunday morning my time, which means much earlier than the Western world. And by the time I was putting it together, the Sunday shows happened in the United States. We had people like Michael Waltz and Sebastian Gorka, whatever his name is. He needs to be referred to as doctor all the time, I realize. And then, you know, everything goes into collision. I mean, what is the Biden administration trying to do exiting power? What is it trying to do to the Trump people? And do the Trump people seem to be going along with it? Can you unravel all of this? Because this time last week, is it Biden is trying to sabotage Trump? It seems like the incoming Trump team seemed to be hand in hand with the outgoing administration.
Well, I think that with Trump, he's not too concerned about anything geopolitical or moral. It's more about his evaluation of December decisions through a business lens. To me, Ukraine looks like a bad deal, but I think he's waiting to hear the terms, because at the end of the day, the United States has funneled over $100 billion into this conflict with no end in sight. So do we leave with and kind of lick our wounds and cut our losses, or do we continue in? Plus, influential voices like Elon Musk and Joe Rogan are also in his ear and amplifying public opposition, which sort of makes Ukraine a 50-50 for the Trump admin, I would think.
Wilmer, what do you think about it? Because Sebastian Gorka, was he given permission to go out and say the bombastic things that he did? I mean, he came out on the Sunday shows more bombastic than anyone in the Biden administration over the last 3 years.
Well, I think what this demonstrates is we have a tendency to think in binary terms, as though it's Biden versus Trump, when in fact this is American foreign policy. And Trump, being the transactional type of individual that he is, he doesn't really have a grounded ideological worldview. So who knows what in the world he's thinking. And on the Biden side, I think what they have decided to do is compress their timeline. The things that they were planning to do, say, in February, March, or April, now that they're on their way out, they're trying to get all of this in probably by the end of November or the middle of December, trying to be sure that they box the Trump administration into a militarism that, at least as it relates to Ukraine and Russia, he'd probably rather not do. But again, I think we also always have to remember it's American foreign policy. It's not necessarily wedded to or dictated by a particular administration.
Well, it's a good point, Eve, in Montreal. So let me see if I get this straight here. We have a failed Biden policy when it comes to Ukraine. They just want to make sure Trump's policy on Ukraine is just as much a failure. That's what I'm getting from here. Go ahead, Eve.
Yeah, I don't know that they consider it a failure. They see fighting to last Ukrainian as a potential success. They see this as weakening Russia still. And they see lots of profits to the military-industrial complex. So I'm not sure that their assessment is exactly our assessment, but I think that there's it will be certainly a failure for Ukraine. That's
for sure.
And it's potentially increasingly could be a failure for all of humanity with the escalatory decision. But clearly, I mean, the Biden administration, with what they're planning and doing, or what they've already done and planning and doing with the $6 billion more in arms in 2 months or whatever, trying to send there, They think this can keep going for a long time, and they think that I think not incorrectly that Trump may just, you know, more or less continue along the same path with whatever dangers that has for Ukrainians and for the world.
You know, Sarah, I think it was two news cycles ago, the New York Times in an article about the situation with the exiting administration and the new administration coming in, just casually mentioned that, you know, there's talk within White House circles that maybe giving nuclear weapons to Ukraine is a possibility. It was mentioned in such a casual way and say, though it could be kind of problematic and complicated. I mean, this is insanity. And it wasn't the headline. Nobody was talking about it on cable, but it was in print as if this is just another one of these options here. This is outrageous. Sarah.
I just feel like it's a way for Washington to kind of wash their hands and absolve themselves of this situation, kind of leave Europe with the bag, or Europe with holding up the NATO narrative, or the NATO foreign policy out there. We also have to remember Trump loves a good narrative, so he could utilize this as a propaganda or a moral victory. He could allow Joe Biden to continue playing chicken with Russia and Putin, and then when he comes in, he could sort of unravel all of this. And, you know, I'm the peacemaker. I kind of laid it off.
But Sarah, you know, it's often said, you know, a week in politics is a lifetime. 5 weeks, what is that? Okay, I mean, you can cause an enormous amount of mischief in the next 5 weeks. Wilmer in Washington, that's what I really worry about, because we finally got the official word that the Ukrainians can shoot in NATO weapons, American, British, French, using NATO forces, personnel, intelligence to strike into Russia. Then the Russians responded with their Hazel missile, as they're calling it in English. We're in the middle of something. We're not at the end of something. Go ahead.
No, this could very well be the beginning of the end. And I think it's also important to include in your explanation here that you're now hearing more rhetoric coming out of Europe. Le Monde is reporting now that the Europeans are talking about war. The Europeans are talking about European business must prepare now to be on a war footing. You've got this Dutch Admiral Rob Bauer, I think, saying these types of jingoistic, this militaristic rhetoric. And now they're even trying to flip the narrative and say that Russia is weaponizing energy, seeming to totally ignore, it was called what, the Nord Stream pipeline, I think, is what the United States blew up. So there's this whole battle of the narrative, which tells me that they're trying to shift the focus, they're trying to shift the basis of reality so that people, I guess they're trying to prepare folks for an escalation of this conflict. And that, just one other quick point, they seem to be confusing the restraint of Russia and the restraint of China with fear. And that is a huge mistake, because I don't know the President Xi is bluffing, and I don't know that President Putin is bluffing.
Well, Eve, I mean, this is a theme that's often on this program, is the battle of narratives. I mean, you know, that's fine. It's another word for propaganda. But if you're basing your decision-making on narratives, you can find yourself in a very bad place. What about reality? Go ahead, Eve.
Yeah, well, we see that here in Canada, in the Canadian government. We see they have completely bought into all of the stuff they've stated about this is the first time European borders are being changed. This is a moral crusade. This is all
the former Yugoslavia was the first time since the Second World War the borders were changed.
Of course, and NATO, there's this NATO convention that's taken place in Montreal this week. Was big protests for three four days over the weekend, they still claim this is a defensive alliance. It's all over. It's a defensive alliance, as if they didn't bomb Libya, as if they didn't war Afghanistan, obviously Yugoslavia. So, but this is popularly believed, and I actually even think Justin Trudeau might even believe this. I'm sure some of his advisors know this is just rhetoric, but the narrative is basically in Canada, for instance, it is overwhelming. There is no dissent of any sense that we provoke us. And we did this press conference on Monday here outside at the end of this NATO convention. And this reporter from the La Presse, one of the corporate dailies, shows up. And he just could not accept that Vladimir Putin wasn't the devil and everything is on Vladimir Putin. NATO hasn't played any role in any of this stuff. And so even with all of the horrors that we're seeing the U.S. and Canada back in Gaza, they still basically believe that NATO is just NATO, the U.S., with just these, you know, the angels just trying
Sarah, I mean, just let me check here. I mean, I live in Moscow. I mean, I haven't heard that Russia is lobbing missiles into Canada and the United States and the United Kingdom. But NATO is doing that in its own technology, and weapons are hitting Russian installations. I mean, there's no parity here. I'm just commenting on what Eve had to say. I mean, who's at war with whom? Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, it's clear what's going on. And since we've even been on here, there's been a confirmation from the Russian Ministry of Defense that those they had called them ballistics prior, but in the Kursk region, those were actually ATACMS, long-range missiles. So this is a confirmation of an escalation. So it's very clear that NATO is upping the game. And you haven't seen missiles in the United States and Canada yet.
I mean, it's really interesting is that to this day, NATO claims it is not involved in the conflict. It's really quite extraordinary. I mean, it's got NATO written all over it, okay? But we're going to talk about how this works out for Ukraine after our break. After that break, we're going to continue our discussion on Biden's foreign policy legacy. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Biden's foreign policy legacy. Okay, let's go back to Wilmer in Washington. All of this posturing that's going on, and I actually looked at the coverage of what was going on in Canada over the weekend. And again, narratives count, but reality is most important. And the reality for Ukraine isn't highlighted enough. I mean, all of this is technically in Ukraine's defense for its protection. But Ukraine is getting smaller and smaller, more and more ruined, and more of its troops do not want to fight. A Gallup poll, not a Ukrainian poll, not a Russian poll, a Gallup poll that says over 50% of people polled want this conflict to come to an end. But Lindsey Graham says it's going to make America rich. Wilmer.
It's funny you mention that, because as you were speaking, my thought was, obviously nobody polled Lindsey Graham, because he doesn't believe that narrative. This is, I think, really one small chess piece in Brzezinski's grand chessboard, and that Russia, that Ukraine is kind of the test bed. It really now doesn't appear to be that President Putin has this grand vision of bringing the band back together and reclaiming the former Soviet republics. It seems to be the United States through NATO trying to deindustrialize Europe and trying to use European countries as new markets for American energy. And this is just the first of
that's a very interesting argument, and it's been around for a while, but it there's some flaws in it. Okay, yeah, Americans want to capture European markets, but if you cut off a cheap energy supplies, then those markets are less valuable, the people are poor, and they won't be able to buy the stuff you want to send them. I mean,
I didn't say it made sense.
I agree. What I'm just saying is that this is often mentioned here, but Europe is not the winner, and you're not going to get the consumers that you want, at least from the American perspective. I mean, it really is self-defeating in many ways. I mean, obviously, the United States wants to, well, right now, and one of the biggest outcomes of this whole conflict is how subservient Europe has become to the United States. I can remember when the Europeans had a different position on Iraq. On Palestine, all of that is evaporated here, which makes it more dangerous because they're just going to do what the Americans say they should do. You know, Eve, one of the, you know, there's a new military base, NATO military base in Poland. The Russians have already said they could be a target if this escalation continues. I believe them.
Yeah, I believe them too. But I do basically believe that Washington has been successful on the level of subordinating Western and Central Europe to its control. And I think that what we've seen, you know, this NATO proxy war has really helped in that. I don't believe this business about Ukraine being really valuable for resources and that being a major motivation. I believe that subordinating Western Europe to U.S. geopolitical aims is a success. And you're right. I mean, you know, to the extent to which they've all gone along with backing Genocide Joe's horrors in Gaza. Is an indication of that, and obviously also this sort of kind of you know, we're going to send troops to Ukraine that the French are talking about. This is all just kind of lashing out that they're realizing how much they've been kind of boxed in. France and others have been boxed in terms of following U.S. policy, and it's actually pretty embarrassing, and I also agree dangerous the fact that they can't seem to get out of this. So in that sense, I think the U.S. has had some major successes. Again, it's, you know, terrible and horrible for Ukrainians, and I also think it's bad for French and, you know, Germans.
Well, Eve, you know, we still hear these ridiculous talking points. It's to save and protect Ukraine's democracy. Well, there's no democracy there. It hasn't been there for a very long time. Its calling card is corruption. This war has made the corruption even worse. So, you know, Sarah, you know, where are the Europeans? Did they get to elect officials, vote on this war? They've never been able to given that opportunity. They will kick out people that support the war. I mean, democracy doesn't even work in Europe when it comes to this.
Oh, absolutely not. We've heard Annalena Baerbock mentioned that we don't care about your opinions, we'll do what we want. And then we're starting to see sort of this crevasse form between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And we can see exactly, as you both mentioned, how much under control Central and Western Europe are under the United States of America. It's pretty interesting to see. We know that all world wars start with Germany, a rising Germany in a relationship with Russia, and this one's no different. And you guys have mentioned the energy and Nord Stream and all of that, and everything was just to put Western Europe back under the American thumb.
Yeah, it was to keep in this case, you know, there was the old phrase during the Cold War, keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. Well, it's to keep the Russians down and out and keep the Germans down and out and Americans in. I think that's the new. And you know what? It has nothing to do with ideology. I mean, most of us here with our young female guests here, but the rest of us are children of the Cold War, that we believed it, okay? But apparently that isn't true anymore, okay? Never was true, apparently. Wilmer, it's interesting. The new doctrine that the Russians have come out with is that expanding its nuclear doctrine, non-nuclear countries that are being supplied with weapons by nuclear power now can be targets. I'm only giving my own personal opinion right here, but since the British are so loudmouth about their participation in all this, I could well imagine one of their bases will get a call and say, you got 2 hours, you got to clear out, and your Article 5, you can explain it to your own people. You're so gung-ho to kill Russians with your missiles, maybe the Russians will return the favor. Go ahead, invoke Article 5. I don't think your people are going to go along with it. Go ahead in Washington.
Well, I don't think that this whole NATO Article 5 deal is really frightening anybody particularly in Russia. And just to piggyback on a point that we were engaged in a little earlier, never underestimate the blindness that attends arrogance. And what I think we're seeing here is an arrogant West, and the European elite I think are in a different space than the Europeans. And the European people are the ones that are going to be really victimized and eviscerated when these missiles start flying. They are the ones that have to go into the street, and they are the ones that are going to have to take control of their countries. And because of the parliamentary systems in many of these countries, it'll be easier for them to do than the duopoly that we have here in the United States. But once these missiles start flying, I think that's when the European people versus the European elite are going to start pouring into the street and saying, we've had enough of this. But only when that happens, we'll see a change.
I really hope that would happen, but let me go to Eve here. I mean, these publics are so propagandized. Piers Morgan had the most ridiculous debate on his podcast. I hate to even kind of promote it, but it was really just ridiculous. No historical references are made, the Minsk process, NATO expansion. I mean, these audiences are so propagandized, they have no facts to grapple with. And because you want to be popular, you just go along with what the powerful say. I mean, this is a real challenge. Of informing people. That's the purpose of this program, actually. Go ahead, Eve.
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's probably not quite as bad in some of the European countries as it is in Canada, for instance, but it's absolutely stunning. The vast, vast majority of people who claim to be even, informed and paying attention to the issue have literally, they don't even know what Minsk Accord was. I've interviewed politicians at Ukraine events, a politician from a left-wing party here in Quebec, and he literally did not know what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And he's come out, he's on the stage, we're going to back Ukraine to the end, and it just kind of rhetoric. And you just, I don't really know how you start in dealing with that. So the political structures, principally the media in this, make it incredibly difficult to overcome that. But, it is possible. And I do also think that one of the things we've seen here in Montreal, like this opposition to Israel's genocide in Gaza, which has been really significant. What we saw over the weekend with the NATO summit is we saw people who've been mobilized around Palestine broadening their views and taking on NATO. And we had 1,500 people march on the NATO summit, and some windows were broken and stuff like that. But it was successful sense that there is some broadening of consciousness about imperialism, Canadian foreign policy, the question of NATO. Will that be enough that the political structures in Europe and the people are able to break free from that before we delve into something incredibly horrible? I don't know, but I think that there's no doubt that people are just completely propagandized on all these issues.
Eve, I'm sorry, Sarah. In looking, like again, I made reference about the Sunday shows. And how bombastic these Trump appointees are. Just kind of very general question. I've asked it before on this program, and I think it's worth asking again. Why is it seems like every time Americans vote for a president, they end up with John McCain?
The ghost of John McCain is still here to haunt us.
Yeah, I mean, he won't. The stench of John McCain will never go away as long as these people walk. Okay, 1 minute, Sarah. Last minute,
go see that. I was just writing a lecture about color revolutions, and I saw John McCain, and then I looked at George, and I was like, "We'll never be rid of this man." So it's funny that you say that he's back again. So yes, John McCain. It's the uniparty. It's that John McCain was such a great example of how the two parties sort of overlap and can kind of push forward and work together in foreign policy. So I love that you picked John McCain because he was sort of that middle of the aisle guy.
But see, when when there's bipartisanship in Washington, that means you have to grab your wallet, close your bank account, and run out the door. Because when these people, they only get together on the most evil things, okay? John McCain was that. He was evil incarnate, okay? It's truly amazing. And I can guarantee you, I have to finish right now, but I can guarantee you we'll be talking about his ghost for a very, very long time. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Montreal, and Seattle. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.